Hey folks, this is Simon Ward. Welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. It's time for another episode where we are devoted to helping you achieve optimal human performance. Please check out my website, simonwardtriathloncoach.com, for all my latest blogs and send your questions to beth@thetriathloncoach.com. If you're not already a subscriber to the show, please go to simonward.podbean.com, where you can subscribe and make sure you don't miss any of our weekly episodes. Hey folks, welcome back. Well, one of the beauties of modern technology is it means it doesn't matter where you are in the world or where your guest is, you can always have a conversation on video. And so today I am joined by Kat Matthews. Now, Kat is currently in Florida. She'll tell us exactly why she's there. But firstly, Kat, welcome. Thanks for being on the show.
Hi, Simon. Thanks very much for having me. I'm definitely enjoying the weather today.
Yeah, well, I guess we haven't got to be too gleeful about our current living conditions, have we? Because a lot of people will be listening to this in the UK and it'd be the middle of winter. But anyway, you know, you take what advantages you can in life. And yeah. One of the advantages of being a professional triathlete is you can chase the sun because that's better for your training.
Yeah, I mean, we have had some really bad storms. If it makes anyone feel better, for the last week, it's been raining, humid, and actually quite miserable. So today is the first day where I've been smiling when I'm looking outside.
You were probably getting a spin-off from that Hurricane Iota, I think, was it? Because it's been the worst season for hurricanes ever. Not the most powerful ones, but they've been right through the alphabet, and now they're back to I again, and they've never had that many. So, and they're normally, you know, end of November, they've gone by now. So sort of quite unlucky. But we'll come on to why you're in Florida in a moment. You're a new triathlete in the pro ranks. So you've been around in the triathlon world for quite a while, and I'd like to catch up on that. But so that people who don't know about you can get a bit more of an idea, when you're not living in Florida temporarily, where do you hang out normally?
So both me and my husband Mark are both in the army. So we move around quite a lot. So in the last couple of years, we've been living in three completely different bits of the UK. But currently we're living just on the outskirts of Bristol, which is actually really nice. We've only been there since the summer, so we haven't actually properly explored because of the COVID lockdown. But it's great. I mean, it's good access to everything, really.
That's quite interesting then, if you're in the army. So how does that work with being a professional triathlete? You're on the BMC Fit team, is that right?
Yeah.
So you're on the BMC team. You know, how does that work with your army career?
So, good question. I joined about, when was it, 2014? So 6 years ago now, as a physiotherapist. Went through Sandhurst, did my officer training, spent 4 years working full-time at Headley Court, the rehab centre, and the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. Before some of my boss was like, have you thought about, you know, committing a little bit more to sport? And you can put in an application backed by your army sport, the national governing body, so British Triathlon, and then sort of UK sport, like Olympic potential. Obviously, endurance sport isn't Olympic potential, but British Triathlon really got behind me and said, actually, yeah, like this person has potential. And the army have a program where it then boards every person who puts in an application for about 10 slots for full-time training. So a lot of those are dedicated towards the Olympics, but also they appreciate that world championships hold just as sort of high level of performance. So I've been on that for 18 months now. And I've just been reselected for another year. So that's how I'm sort of in the army still serving. But my job role at the moment is in sport, which is obviously an absolute privilege.
It does help having a contract with somebody like BMC, doesn't it? Because clearly that's better than somebody who's turned pro and then has to rely on the winnings that they'll get to keep them going to the next race.
For me, the BMC BFIT team is the biggest part of that is the sort of confidence and support around the team ethos. I think having sort of basically a sports performance manager, a team manager, we've got a team doctor, a physio, and the support from the other sponsors that support the team. So it's nice to be able to sort of tap into, for example, like Stella Italia or FSA and talk about how I can, you know, adapt my saddle or change my bike position. And actually, for me, that's what the positive is. It's not about the sort of financial support. It's more about being part of the team and like the confidence that comes with somebody else saying, you're good enough, like keep trying, which is quite nice.
So obviously, if you're moving around a lot, no pets then, nothing, nobody, no dog at home to go running with or walking with?
No, I think me and Mark are both pretty keen on the idea of spontaneity. And although I love to sort of play with animals as such, you know, the occasional dog walk, my family have always had dogs. I don't think we're ready to accept that responsibility yet.
No, it's... I do the same. I do quite a lot of traveling. I'd love to have a dog to go running with, you know, and most of my friends have got dogs, but then I keep thinking, well, it wouldn't be fair to have put it into a, you know, put the dog into kennels or leave them with somebody else, you know, every sort of couple of months. It's you've got to be committed to having a pet like you have with children, really, haven't you?
Yeah. Some say it's more commitment to have a dog than it is to have a child, but I'm not sure about that.
I don't have children either, so no. What about you? What about outside of triathlon? Then any hobbies and you know, when you're not training, how do you like to relax?
I'm pretty good at sitting on the sofa, especially during lockdown. Netflix has been my friend, but now apart from that, I think I try and maintain a pretty normal social life as much as possible. Obviously, outside of the COVID restrictions that's taught last year, for example, your friends and family. I actually really love training. So I actually feel like I often do my hobby as my job at the moment. So I don't feel necessarily that I need other hobbies as such. But me and Mark definitely enjoy very lazy Sunday morning brunches and the crossword and general just sort of chitter chatter and going to the pub, even if I'm not able to drink alcohol during most of the training season. But yeah, very sort of chill millennial life, probably.
You're both sort of quite well engaged in triathlon, because Mark's a competitive age group triathlete as well, isn't he? Pretty good one. So I guess, do you have friends that have no connection to triathlon, so that when you go out, your conversation doesn't talk about the latest bikes and what your power was going up the hill and who's got the best King of the Mountains things on Strava?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, triathlon can be quite all-encompassing. And I think that that's something that I know I work quite hard on, not trying to let that sort of overbear in our life. And Mark's much better at it than me. But I think a lot of my friends now, seeing me sort of race at the level I am, they really understand, and actually they're really supportive. And most of my friends love running and cycling anyway, so those things come up naturally in conversation. But no, we're definitely not talking about aerodynamics and power on the bike and things like that. There's a lot more sort of normal chitter as well.
I don't know if you are a sport historian for triathlon. There was Norman Stadler was Ironman world champion twice, actually, probably in the last 10 years, super biker. But I remember having a conversation with him, and he said none of his friends were triathletes. He has no triathlon memorabilia or anything. So if you went into his house, you wouldn't know he was a triathlete, because once he'd put his bike away and finished training, he wanted to escape from that world and sort of disconnect,
nice.
which I found quite refreshing, really.
I'm definitely not a shrine person. I don't sort of, like, I chuck most of my medals.
Oh, really?
It's not about the, I try and recycle them, of course. It's not about the, the memorabilia for me. It's just about the pure enjoyment of the sport, which is a bit cringe, but yeah.
It's quite an interesting point that I one of my podcasts that I do regularly is with a couple of other of my coaching mates called the Grumpy Old Coaches, and we got a load of people to ask us questions, and one of them last time was, should you keep your medals and your T-shirts and your race numbers, or should you just throw them away? And Mark Laithwaite was saying that, but both he and myself and Steve Lumley, we've all been racing since we were probably we've been doing triathlon for 30 years each. So that's a long time in the sport. And I think probably we were sort of on the same lines as you, except we've kept significant race memorabilia, you know, first time in Hawaii, first Ironman, first time you won a race, you know, first race you did. Mark was saying that he was recently going through some cupboards that his dad had shown him and found some of his dad's old cross-country race medals. And his dad was saying, oh, yeah, I remember that one. Oh, let me tell you what happened in that race. And he thought, oh, do you know what? Actually, the stories that go along with those memories, because he saw the number or the medal, it reminded him about some interesting part of his life. He said, I actually wish I'd kept a few more of my things now. Perhaps you're not old enough to be nostalgic yet, Kat.
Well, I've kept the biggies, like you say.
Yeah.
Maybe then I just focus on those. Maybe I haven't got enough to sort of shrine yet.
Well, I mean, the thing is, every race has a story, doesn't it? You know, it's not just about the number and the medal. It's about the stories that go with it or the journey to it. And I suppose those are the things that you remember when you look at a medal. It's like, oh, that was the one where I had a bike crash 2 weeks before. Or that was the one where, you know, I did this or that. So, yeah. But anyway, each to their own. Okay. So what about reading then? You didn't mention reading as one of your hobbies. Do you read books at all?
I occasionally read books. But I am a bit of more of an audiobook sort of person.
Okay.
I think just I'd rather sit down and watch TV or listen to an audiobook when I'm training. I did just listen to Michelle Obama's book,
Which
absolutely loved. I mean, I'm late to the party there, I know. But a lot of my books that I read are more sort of sadly sports performance based. Yeah, I think that's more where I listen to them when I'm training, because I sort of feel like I can get a double hit out of that training session. If it's like a steady run or a steady ride, I can sort of be learning something at the same time, which is quite nice.
You watching any box sets or anything on Netflix, or have you?
I'm too embarrassed to tell you what stuff I binge on Netflix.
Oh, go on. I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what I've watched since lockdown started, and then you share, and then we've both embarrassed ourselves. So I started off by watching Homeland, and I caught up on all 8-7 series of that one, which is about, okay, I think probably about 80 episodes. Oh, I watched Vikings.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, and then from Vikings, I got into Ozark, which is brilliant.
Oh, you so love it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then one of my friends had been watching The Last Kingdom, which was very similar to Vikings, too, except with an Anglo-Saxon spin. And now I am watching, it's escaped me now, House of Cards with Kevin Spacey. Now, you can say what you like about Kevin Spacey and his little sort of indiscretions, but he's a brilliant actor. And
he's very good.
Yeah. Okay, go on. It's your turn.
And so I have to admit, I've watched probably all of those. I am doing the classic British thing at the moment about watching The Crown.
One of my friends has just told me he's watching that. He says it's brilliant.
Yeah, I love it. I'm just popping my headphones in. But I am also guilty of just binge watching and rewatching Gossip Girl.
Right, no, not familiar with that one. So we'll have to put Gossip Girl down on the show now.
Yeah, I think I've probably watched the whole, I don't know how many series there are, at least 3 or 4 times.
Well, so my friend who's watching The Crown, we've been watching all of these series together and then catching up with each other and sort of saying, yeah, what, having to be really careful, saying, oh, you won't guess what happened last night. And he's got a tendency to watch 4 or 5 episodes, so he's a bit ahead of me saying, yeah, so-and-so got killed. No, don't tell me that one. I didn't know.
Ozark is good.
Yeah, Ozark. Okay. So you live in Bristol. You're in Florida at the moment. Where of all the places in the world would you choose to live if you could, that would allow you to fulfill your training and just live in a place of beauty?
I know you probably wouldn't agree, but I actually think the classic nature of Britain is where I'd choose. Like somewhere in the Cotswolds, good transport links to get into the city. I think, like some lovely country roads, somewhere like that, but not too far north that I'd have to travel quite far. My family are in Devon, so I'd quite like to be able to travel around. Yeah, I wouldn't choose anywhere like crazy, like Boulder or anything like that. I think I'd definitely stick in England.
No,
I would like to travel.
I think I'd agree with you on that. I mean, I you know, obviously I get to travel to some nice places and train in some nice places, but I like going back to Yorkshire. My dad lives in Dorset, and so I've done a bit of riding down there, and I'm always, you know, blown away by the beauty and the quietness of the roads compared to where I live. But North Yorkshire up near Richmond's pretty nice. I don't think I could live anywhere else. I like going back to Yorkshire, but it's nice to travel away as well, particularly when the weather's not so good at home.
Yeah, no, like spending a few weeks in Lanzarote every so often is pretty nice. A bit of a luxury.
Just a little bit of sunshine, a little injection of sunshine and warmth.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got a few silly questions for you then. So what sort of animal do you think you'd be if you were an animal?
I hate this question. Not that I've answered it very much, but I was thinking this. I was actually thinking I saw a really like one of those cringe videos on Facebook the other day. I would choose a puma because.
A puma? Okay.
Yeah. I think I, not that it describes me, but I would quite like to be it or seen as it. It's just like it's quite a powerful animal, but it's got sort of poise and I don't know. There's also like a sort of majestic nature about it, but it's also really quite cool as well.
Oh, well, you're the first person to choose puma. Most ones are dolphins or lions.
Oh, yeah. They're boring.
Dolphins and lions are the most popular. Okay, yeah, I guess most of my older guests, they're always a bit stumped by this one. But when you get the chance to go to Kona, you'll see Mike Riley comes onto the stage to Who Are You from The Who. And it's got the song's called Bubba Riley, which sort of is his signature walk-on tune. So if you were going to have a walk-on tune when they call you up on stage, have you got something you'd like to accompany?
Oh, a walk-on tune. I'm not sure about that. But obviously, hopefully, I'll have to think about that one day. I do have a bit of a favourite song generally, like in the background. It's like Heather Small, Proud.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it really struck me when I was a kid. Mm. It's like before the 2012 Olympics. Mm-hmm. I was still playing hockey at quite a high level. And I think it was one of those like motivational sort of promo video songs. Like I didn't make the national team, but I was still like sort of starry eyed at the idea of going to the Olympics.
Yes.
And the wording of it, it's really stuck with me. Like I don't listen to it that much, but like the idea of like, what have you done today to make you feel proud? Like I get a lot out of that. I think, yeah.
When you put together a song like that with some powerful words and a powerful video as well, it can have quite a lot of impact, can't it?
Yeah, definitely.
I remember that Dan Hunt showed us the video he'd made for the men's pursuit team for 2012. And it was, I think it's 5 minutes long, and it was Eminem, Let's Get Down to Business. Oh, no, Eminem, I'm Not Afraid. And he showed it to a group of level three coaches and the tutors. And everybody just sat there open-mouthed and like, wow. And then one of the guys said, can I have a copy of that? And he said, no. He said, that video is only for the five guys who are in the team and the coaches, and that's it. It's never going outside. You guys are privileged to have been able to see that, but please, you're not sharing it, I'm afraid. And that was it. But it was a brilliant, brilliant piece of music and some fantastic footage of the team and all the training they did together and some of the bonding stuff. And you could see why you'd be motivated if you were just watching it just before a race.
Yeah, definitely.
You afraid of anything? You have any fears?
I think, well, actually, lockdown has sort of exposed a fear, I guess. The idea... It's not necessarily a realistic fear, but then I guess fears can always be rationalised. It's the idea of like not being in control of the choice, like the path of your life. I think I definitely realised at one point when I was sort of spiralling into the black hole of pessimistic thinking in lockdown that, you know, maybe I wouldn't get an opportunity to be the professional athlete that I wanted to be.
Right.
And I think that scared me, like the idea that I wouldn't be able to choose the path that I wanted. Mm. Yeah, maybe a bit deep.
I'm not afraid of spiders
or anything like that.
No, but that's really interesting, sort of almost like unfulfilled potential, isn't it? But just not unfulfilled because you didn't give it everything you could, unfulfilled because of other things that just got in the way, which is a terrible thought to have to go through your life thinking, if only.
Yeah, definitely.
What about mottos? Do you have anything that you know, any wise words that you like to live by or that you sort of repeat to other people?
I think maybe you touched on it already. Like for me, it's about choice. Like I think we've got a lot of control over our emotions and our thoughts. The proud thing as well, like you can choose whether you finish the day feeling proud. And then there's always one that I think back to before races. And it's like, I think I actually saw it on, someone reshared it. Maybe it was Matt Botter or something at some point last year. But the idea that fitness isn't about comparing yourself to others. It's about comparing yourself to yourself and like getting better. I don't know the exact words. I'm not very good at that, like remembering details. But yeah, I like that idea. It gives me confidence going into a race that I don't have to worry about other people, even though I'm racing them. I just have to do the absolute best I can do, and then I can be happy.
Yeah, there's another phrase to do with comparison that I use, which is, it's comparison's the thief of joy. You know, you could go out for a great run in the woods. You could see a deer, or you could see, you know, you could see a bed of bluebells just flowering, and the sun's just rising, and you know, you have a fantastic run. And then you come back and then you look at your watch and it's like, wow, that was slower than last week. And all of that joy that you just had about the pleasure of the runs just gone. It's the watch.
That's basically describes my run just now.
And, you know, I do think that people get into comparing stuff far too much. But the only time you really need to compare stuff is either in test sets or when you're racing, really.
Yeah.
And even then, it's not easy, is it, to compare things, because everything's different. Even the same race is different with the weather conditions and the competition, so, and your set state of mind.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we talked about this. We talked about you becoming a professional triathlete this year. Do you feel like you were? I mean, you were racing as an age grouper before, but do you feel like you were racing as a pro because of your approach to training and racing before, and the fact that army life perhaps gave you a bit more control over your time?
I guess I don't really understand the question. I raced as an age grouper 2017 and 2018,
right,
until March 2018. Sorry, 2019. Did one race in 2019 as an age grouper, and did well enough to qualify for the British Triathlon license. They're really quite strict about it, as I'm sure everyone knows. And then because I had done so well in that race, it gave me the confidence that I could take the step up straight away. And then the first race I did, which was 5 weeks later, which was Stafford, I came third to Lucy Charles and Emma Pallant and qualified for Nice that same year. So I think that was quite a nice, like, oh, actually, whoa, okay, I am good enough. Because I did my first 70.3 in 2018. So it was only the third or fourth race that I'd done that I had then sort of jumped up. But I think in terms of hours and like the flexibility side, I was working full time all of 2018. And then 2019, I was able to drop 8 to 10 hours a week of my clinical job in a hospital. So I was still working that sort of 30 hours. And I was just training really consistently morning and evening, and then at the weekend as well. It wasn't until I had gained my professional license that actually around this exactly the same time, but not as a result of, the army said, okay, you can train full time. So it's sort of, it just worked out really well that I'd already achieved that tick box, which I didn't think I was going to achieve until later in the year.
I think that was probably what I was trying to say. I didn't articulate it very well. Is it just in terms of time to train? And, you know, for a lot of age groupers, they're working and they're fitting training in around work and everything else. Then all of a sudden they've got this opportunity to be a pro triathlete. They're not working anymore and there's all this extra time. And sometimes that's a good thing, but for some people it's not, because they fill all that time with training and then they get ill or injured and, you know, they're off to a false start.
Yeah,
really.
I think a lot of professionals still keep their job while they're sort of starting out, but I can see that there's a definite bonus to obviously not having a job. Yes. I'm really invested in the idea of sort of psychological load alongside the physiological load of training. So I think if, especially for me and other people with high level sort of cognitive jobs, because of physio, I was being so stressed in terms of what I was having to sort of thought process and work out and analyze and help and emotionally support other people during the day. But it was really stressful as such, stressful on the mind and therefore the body. And I think that I've definitely noticed a difference in terms of how well I recover from not doing as much clinical work But I don't think that you can't do both. And I think a lot of people think you have to be full-time athlete to be a professional. And there are still some high-performing athletes who do have other jobs. But it is definitely hard. Like I remember, obviously, really clearly looking back to that sort of 6 months before turning professional, where I was working, and the commitment that you have to put in. You know, it's that those 5 a.m. starts. Mm. You know, to get to swimming, you've already packed your breakfast the night before. You're rushing to work. You're slightly sweaty at work. You know, you're worrying about what you're having for lunch because you've got a training session at 5, and then you can't eat dinner. But then, that it's amazing. The amount of effort that you have to put in at that level when you're doing a job and triathlon. But I also spiraling along what you're saying about people just then suddenly upping all their training hours, I strongly believe, and I was supported by a really down-to-earth guy, my coach Damo Littlewood, throughout the whole last 3 years, is that you don't have to just train more. It's all about this training stress rather than training volume. Mm. And I think everyone gets their head stuck around this idea of training volume.
Yeah.
Whereas actually we just want to optimize the stress on the body so we can get the best adaptation, ideally with the least amount of volume. But obviously volume does work in some cases for adaptation.
Yeah, that a fantastic fantastically well put, Kat. I've often thought that if you were an age grouper and you were averaging 14 hours a week, say, and then all of a sudden you didn't have to go to work, rather than upping your training, just imagine that the benefit you could get from those 14 hours by being able to sleep an extra hour a night, not having to, like you say, not having to rush your breakfast, rush off to the pool. You could spend a little bit more time cooling down afterwards. You can take your time over preparing some quality food. You can have a little nap. You know
that's exactly what I did.
And I think, you know, all stress is accumulative, right? You'll know that from your physio background, that work is a stress, life is a stress, COVID's been a stress for a lot of people, training is a stress, and they all go in the same bucket. And you can't go for a 10K run to try and wipe out the stress of a bad case that you've had to work out. It's just more stress. Nicely put that, very, very nicely put. There's not a lot of people understand that. So that's maybe one of those things I would highlight in our podcast.
Well, I'm happy to be a case study. My hours really sort of, I think, shock a few people. So that first year in 2019, I don't keep a track of this because, like we said, to me, hours isn't a sort of training marker. But my coach was reflecting on it at the end of the year, and he said, "Kat, do you realise that you only averaged, I think it was like 11 hours a week of actual training minutes during that 2019 season?" So when I was sort of full time, I was doing a day a week physio when I was in the UK. And that was just a sort of exactly like you said, I was able to plan my meals during the day for when I was training, make sure my run wasn't at 6 a.m. and it was at 11 a.m. after a really good, you know, high carbohydrate breakfast, that my swim, if it was a recovery session, it was in the afternoon. If it was a high intensity one, I prioritized it, you know, like exactly like you say. I just think that the psychological sort of preparation of those high intensity sessions meant that you get the quality out of them as well.
Do you get injured much? Have you been injured much in the last sort of 2 or 3 years?
I think when you say much, it's on a scale of what we think is normal. I'm definitely an advocate for the fact that if you're an endurance athlete, especially runners, you are going to get injured. So it's normal. So I think that we should sort of normalize injuries. Obviously, we don't want them as much as we get them ever. I have a few sort of areas of my body that I have to pay specific attention to in terms of just monitoring the load. So I had a big injury, sort of overload knee injury in 2018, and it still creeps its ugly head up sometimes. But normally all it takes is a sort of, you know, a new set of cleats, a couple of days of lighter load, and I'm back in the game. And then I think calves is always a triathlete's burden. So I do enough to tolerate that. And actually this year I've been really lucky. I've only had a couple of niggles in my calves. And last year I had a couple of sessions missed because of carbs, but otherwise I've been quite consistent.
Well, that word you just used at the end there about consistency, what I wasn't really trying to you know, find out about your injury history or how prone you were, more to try and emphasize the fact that you were saying, yeah, I've averaged 11 hours a week, but if you average 11 hours a week for 52 weeks without really missing any training time due to injuries, that accumulation of training can have a huge impact. I did something really recently when I showed the tortoise versus the hare. So the tortoise, you know, accumulates the training load very carefully and assiduously, but never it pushes on a little bit, but doesn't get injured. The hare goes racing off, does loads of training. We all know people like that. They're going really well. You keep getting dropped by them on the climbs, and then they're saying, "Yeah, I'm in top form now," but then they get injured or ill, and then all of a sudden you're a bit fitter than them, and they have to start again. But they're all really enthusiastic, and they're going to catch up, so they try and smash the training again. And over the long run, you're probably better off just doing a little bit less training, but not missing anything.
Yeah, Matt, I completely agree. Obviously, this year I've had a lot more time and I've upped that volume to, I think, sort of 18, 20 hours. But exactly like you say, I've done that week in, week out. But looking back at training peaks, you know, it's 78 hours, 78 hours, 78 hours. If you're going to look at hours as a marker, but otherwise you look at TSS. Completely agree.
Well, I mean, and everybody talk about hours, don't they? It's about the quality of the training that you do. Some people can get away with doing less, some people respond to more. I think that's another thing, isn't it, that you have to find out what works for you. And it doesn't matter what the research says or what everybody else is doing. Once you've found a solution that works for you, nobody can argue with that, really.
Well, I think particularly if you're winning
races, if you're winning races and you've got a solution that works, then you must be doing a pretty good job. And then it's a question of fine-tuning things, really, rather than making huge changes.
Yeah, and I think so, like, talking about me specifically, I think what I've learned and then is applicable to sort of coaching other people is that exactly that, like, there's not one way. Just because it works for me, it doesn't mean it's going to work for somebody else. And also there's this idea of, like, making sure that we take into account their sort of last 5 years. So I've come into endurance sport from a background of, you know, team sport. I used to be quite good at cross country running as a kid, and I did some swimming, but I never had this base of long endurance. And I think I'd hope that in next year I'm doing another couple of hours, you know, on average a week, and then next year I'm able to cope with another couple of hours. But I think it's just really gradual, back to that tortoise, and looking at somebody's training history is obviously really key when you're sort of trying to work out where to go with them to start with.
It's quite interesting. I think Marinda Carfrae came from playing basketball, of all things. Craig Alexander played football. Both of those guys are fantastic looking runners. I really like their running style, but they're also very resilient. And I do wonder that if you come from a background of sport, and again, you'll probably be able to add something from your physio background and knowledge here, is that when you come from a background of team sport where you are doing multi-directional activities for your fitness, you know, there's a lot of agility, there's balance. You find a lot of the triathletes that have been triathletes since they were young perhaps don't have the balance and coordination skills that you'd expect for somebody playing in a team sport. So you develop bone strength and density from different angles because you're constantly changing. There's a sort of more of a plyometric act. There's different intensity levels to the training because of the sprinting, you know, backwards running, all of that sort of stuff. I've got no data to back it up, just my own understanding. My own understanding from working with cricketers and rugby league players and team sports players as a fitness condition, that basis gives you a huge amount of resilience that perhaps endurance athletes don't have.
I think all of those theories are very sound. However, I think I'd counterbalance that with the fact that if you're playing, even if you're playing non-contact team sports, there's a massive. I would put money on the fact that you'll have had a lot more injuries, like traumatic injuries in terms of knee, sort of ligament sprains, ankle massively twisted ankles, you know, maybe even some head injuries and stuff. So I think that there's also a lot of negatives that could have potentially impact.
True. You know, future. True. Very true. Tell us
pros and cons.
You signed for BMC, so that was obviously a massive confidence boost to you. You know, anybody coming into sport and getting signed up by a well-known team like that, great, and they've got some, I'm not sure of who's on the roster at the moment, but they've had some great athletes running for them in the past. So you've been signed up by someone new, but then of course everything gets interrupted by coronavirus. So how's that been, and has it caused any anxiety at all, not being able to sort of express your potential and do what you were signed up for?
Yes, definitely. I think any pressure and sort of anxiety was definitely self-induced. The communication from the team, I think, has been amazing. They spoke to us really early on about, you know, the difficulties that we might be facing. And, you know, just sort of to crack on as best we could. But again, like I mentioned, I think the support side from it, for me, was the biggest boost. But in terms of sort of not, I think there's a lot in there. I think from, like, you come onto the social media bit of this COVID challenges when you talk about, you know, how the expectation of performing, because obviously without the racing, I felt like we were being asked to do a lot of sort of media engagement with the sponsors, which I obviously was completely new to, and I hadn't actually performed and built up those relationships already with the sponsors. So I think for me, it was quite hard on social media to just keep saying, look at me, I'm a professional athlete, whereas I didn't feel like I'd actually sort of done anything yet, even though I had obviously raced quite a bit in the year before as a, yeah, you know, outside the team. So that was really quite hard, especially when I know that I'm not the sort of, oh, look at her, she must be world champion because she looks like the best athlete. I know that I don't necessarily fit that sort of stereotypical fit look. Perhaps, maybe that's my own negative perception. So yeah, I think the expectation from the team side was definitely sort of, any sort of anxiety was self-induced, but I took a lot of confidence from, and I wrote a bit of an interview with John from Try 24/7 recently. Oh, yeah, about, yeah, it.
Okay.
Because my job in as such is a professional athlete, I, you know, within the army and outside of the army, I just took that sort of confidence and sort of control, like discipline, just to say, this is my job, I'm just going to go to work today. So that was really nice for me to be able to just have that sort of composure and just tick on every day. And like you say, it's meant actually that the consistency has been there like throughout the whole year for me, hence probably why I'm performing now.
Well, let's talk about that performance. You went to Florida recently and had one of the best. That was your first Ironman distance, right?
Second,
okay.
Yeah.
But first as a pro?
Nope.
Oh, okay. I raced. Right. I need to do my homework a bit more.
No, that's okay. I raced my first Ironman in December 2019, so a year ago. And that was Western Australia.
Okay, right.
Yeah. I went out to watch Tallinn in 2019, and it was before Nice, and I basically was like, I think I could probably do an Ironman, and then wanted to go abroad somewhere, and we sort of tied in our honeymoon for Australia. And Australia, my debut, I did 8:53, and sort of hit exactly what I had hoped to hit in all three disciplines, but I came fourth because the other three girls all broke the course record, and they're all amazing. And so obviously that was an amazing day out, but without podiuming, and then to come and back to Florida, yeah, second Ironman, and yeah, pretty happy with how it went.
So tell us about that. Well, I'm interested in the whole experience because races have started up again in the US. I mean, I know we've had a couple in the UK, and I worked at Outlaw X. So I think you were racing there, weren't you? Did you race, yeah, Outlaw X? Yeah. So
yeah.
What was your experience of the way in which WTC organised Florida versus how things were organised at Outlaw X? Was it very similar in terms of management of athletes and crowd?
Yeah, the only difference was that Outlaw had posted out the numbers to everybody already, so you weren't having to go through the queuing process. But the way the events that I've been to, so both Tallinn 70.3 and Ironman Florida, it's all very strict. You know, it's one-way systems, it's masks on at all times, sanitizer everywhere, all of the staff are wearing face masks. It's a sort of non-touch policy. We were given our own pen to sign any waivers. And it's all in America, obviously, it's all open air as well. So there was no, I didn't feel enclosed at all at any point. And then racing wise, we were wearing a mask until you get stood on the start line. In Florida, we were stood on the beach at 2 meter intervals on a cone. So honestly, at no point was I actually ever in contact with anybody, even in the swim, because it was a sea swim. And then post race, the finish line, you know, I set the finish line photo, I was sort of forced a mask on even for the finish line photo. So yeah, it was pretty, and there was zero contact. There was way more interaction at Outlaw than there was out here in Florida, actually. But I wouldn't say that Outlaw, Outlaw ticked all the boxes as well. So I think everyone's just done really well.
Mm. What was it like crossing the line then? I mean, I don't know what the crowds are like at Florida, but I guess they weren't anywhere near what they would normally be. And of course, Mike Riley's trying to do his best to create some atmosphere there, but, you know, probably fighting a losing battle, really. I mean, he's got a lot of energy, Mike, but...
Yeah, he has got a lot of energy. I think he did a good job. But so in Florida, the run course was out and back on a... quite a big road, so there was some locals supporting on the side of the road, but in terms of the finish line, there was about 800 meters to get to the finish line through a car park, and the whole finish line strip, all of that was completely bare. So yeah, it was obviously as rewarding as any Ironman, I think, crossing the finish line, but I think that there was something lacking, but I nothing to complain about, because obviously it's a privilege to be racing. So
yeah, I mean, I've been watching the rugby from, you know, England playing at Twickenham. They'd normally have 80,000 people there. I've watched Liverpool and Manchester United play, and they'd normally have 50,000-70,000 people and an amazing atmosphere. And then obviously I've watched some of the Ironman finishes, and I've been at the finish lines when there's been lots of people there, and it's an amazing atmosphere when Riley and his commentators get everybody wound up. So some people would say, well, you're a professional athlete, so you have to do what you do in the circumstances you're given. But there's got to be that lack of atmosphere has got to have some impact, surely, on performance levels. No,
not that I think of, to be honest. But I don't know if I'm unique in that. At no point did I feel whenever I'm racing anyway, it's more about your own personal battles in your own head rather than any external sort of praise that you're getting at the time. I think you can only push yourself as hard as you can push yourself. And so I know there's all of my sort of friends and family back home. Everyone's on the app. I know they're there. It's just there, obviously.
I suppose it's different in triathlon, because for a large portion of the race, you are actually out there on your own, aren't you? And there might only be one man and his dog stood by the side of the road clapping, but he doesn't really know who you are. Whereas if you're playing a team game in a stadium, you know, you normally, you've got the spectators there for the 80 or 90 minutes of the game. Okay, so you've stayed in Florida. So that's next up then, Daytona, yeah?
Yeah. So I've just spent the last couple of weeks after the race doing very little. It's felt a little bit lazy, but my body definitely needed it. It's definitely in the first week, and then the second week, I've just tried to stay disciplined. Mm-hmm. And now I'm just starting. I've got about a week of some pretty, you know, relatively decent training, and then race week next week. So quite exciting. It's going to be an interesting race.
Yeah, go on. Tell us what you think is going to be interesting about it then.
So I think when the start list is published, it will be more discussable. But at the moment, it's obviously a 2K swim, an 80K bike and an 18K run. So a really unique distance. It's got ITU athletes in, as well as long course and some sort of specific middle distance athletes. So obviously with a 2K swim, the ITU guys are going to have a slight advantage in theory. But for the rest of the race, I think us long course will show our strength in the TT position and then onto a hard run. So I think that will be really good to sort of showcase actually what we can do compared to some of the sort of shiny stars, shall we say, in the Olympic circuit. I mean, that's what's exciting to me, because I've never been a part of that world. I know a lot of long course athletes have come from that world, so it's maybe not necessarily, you know, that special to them. But the whole race is obviously in the NASCAR circuit. So there's a lake in the middle of the track. It's a 4K track. It's a 20-meter drafting rule, I think. So I'm intrigued to see how they're going to police this, and how it will work with the laps and the time splits between people. Because I think from the front pack to the back of the pack out the swim, we might see more than a 4K loop. Yeah. So I don't know how that will work out. And, you know, how that will be allowed in terms of, well, if so-and-so is a lap behind, will they be allowed to sit 20 metres behind somebody else? I'm still a bit intrigued. And then obviously the whole race being so enclosed means that you'll be constantly on it. So even though, like you were saying, with the crowds, there won't be crowds, but there'll be this idea that you're being constantly watched. Yeah. So I think that would be quite nice, like to sort of feel part of the race for the whole 3-4 hours, however long it takes. I think it's exciting.
I was chatting with a couple of the Canadian guys, Jackson Laundrie and Taylor Reed, and they were saying that the media they're using for the filming and everything are the guys that do the NASCAR. So they've got some really great technical innovations that they use on the car racing that they're going to try and apply to the triathlon here. So be interesting to see what they come up with there, because that's going to make it great for the viewers.
Yeah, there was some chatter that I saw on one video about it, that they were going to try and link up heart rate and speed and have it on the screen displayed. So yeah, I think exactly that is one of the main purposes of the race is obviously to, you know, showcase the sport, and that's showcasing it through media to everybody else who's not racing. So I think, and a lot of the professionals are obviously really on board with that idea, so I think everyone's really keen to support sort of pushing look at how great triathlon is as a whole for everybody this year. I definitely think we've got some unique sort of talents as triathletes in terms of coping with some serious stress, which is obviously what we've been through with the COVID era.
Well, this is an event that's been heavily promoted by PTO, and some of the other pro athletes I've spoken about have been very complimentary in terms of the help that PTO have given people since, I spoke to Sam Renouf at the beginning of the year. He was just starting his role as chief operating officer, and then 2 months later, he's having to deal with all of this situation. So talk about being in at the deep end. But Elliot Smales from Leeds is had a good start to his career, but really needed the handout that and the grants that PTO were giving out to athletes. What benefits have you felt from being involved with the PTO this year during the COVID situation?
I think it's really exciting, the idea that there's a group of people, some which are athletes themselves and some which are more about management, trying to influence the future of the sport. I think to me that's the most exciting thing. They're really trying to work to further like how the sport is going to work in the future. It's not for me personally, it's not about the sort of handouts, as you say, or the bonuses. Obviously, that's it's an absolute gift to be supported by them. They put a lot of prize money behind local races this year, and I think that was really big. I think that is, it's not necessarily, again, about necessarily the prize money, but it obviously is, it really supports professional athletes. It's about giving them the opportunity to race. I know that we wouldn't necessarily have had those opportunities if the PTO hadn't supported it. So yeah, that's good. And obviously everything that they've done with Challenge Daytona, and also looking forward to some of their policies, like they've just released the maternity and paternity status side of life. So I think it's definitely in its developing stage, and I think we just need to keep the momentum in terms of where it's going. But at the moment, it's brilliant for the professional athletes. And I think what we need to then look forward to is how that's then going to impact all of the sport in terms of age group racing as well. Like, I think sometimes with triathlon, perhaps the sort of transition and the way we see professional sport isn't exactly the same as other sports. I think they see it very separately, and you know, in other sports the sort of the age group side of life and the amateurs are absolute massive fans of the professionals, and the professionals are supporting the age group. And I think that's something that we should be also really working on. And having come from, you know, that age group sort of rank as such, and never believing that I would be a professional athlete, I think for me that's something that I hold quite close, is that, you know, the sport is for everybody and it's not just about professionals, which has been quite hard this year because obviously that's the only people who've really been able to race as much. But hopefully next year it'll all come together and the PTO will sort of work as, you know, to be both age group and professional as well.
Well, I mean, this race is coming up in a few weeks in Daytona. They've got the biggest prize money that's ever been put up for a race. But probably one of the more interesting developments for me that I've seen sort of brewing over the last few years is that they've made the prize money equal between males and females. They've got equal numbers of females on the start list, which is something that the female athletes have been trying to negotiate with WTC at Ironman, and they've never managed it. So that's a big step forwards. And in line with the grants and payments they've made, they're actually going to make sure they distribute the that prize purse out to everybody. That I'm not quite sure whether it's everybody who starts the race or everybody who finishes the race.
Yeah, no, we were actually discussing that the other day. Who knows? Definitely with the equality, like the equality to male and female ratio is a really unique in triathlon compared to a lot of sports, and it's an absolute privilege. Ironman, I think, have done a very good job as well, and all of the other companies, I know that Challenge, I know that local companies, they always offer equal prize money for male and female. Whether that's actually fair is another question, and actually whether it's positively biasing the females is a topic of conversation, because obviously there's a lot of more professional male athletes just by the nature of more males doing sport. And I know that the ITU have been doing this for a really long time and it hasn't increased the numbers of females in this sport. So I think that's a whole nother discussion for maybe another day. But in terms of what the PTO is doing with Daytona, it's amazing. Like the idea of being able to turn up to a race, knowing that you're not going to be out of pocket, is brilliant. And that sound would be really bizarre for any other sport to think that people were paying to go to a race as a professional. So I feel like that should be, you know, a benchmark of what would be acceptable, like at least having zero sort of balance when you're going to turn up to a race. So they're putting us up in accommodation as well as paying us to start or finish, whichever one.
I think that's an important and interesting point you make there, Kat, because I think perhaps a lot of our listeners wouldn't realise that pro triathletes, they're not given, they're not sort of given a call by the agencies, right? We'd like you to come and do this race. We'll sort out your flights and we'll give you a week's accommodation in this hotel. You've got to pay your own way to get there. You've got to generally find your own accommodation. So it's not uncommon, in Kona, for instance, for you to find four or five athletes sharing a house there to minimise the costs, sharing one car. And then if you have a mechanical, or if you have some sort of accident or injury, which means that you start the swim and then you don't finish, that's it. You're not going to pick up any prize money. So now your travel costs and accommodation down. And even when you do get into the prize money, once you've taken off your local tax, I mean, sometimes you don't get paid out. You know, it's not like you get a check as soon as you get off the podium, is it? Sometimes you've got to wait for that money to clear. So that with certain races, that could be a while. Even if you come third or fourth, you could still be out of pocket if you've been to a big race. And so, again, like you say, who would have thought that going to do your job, getting on the podium, means that you're actually in a net loss?
Yeah, and that's where the chat about, you know, the top 10 professional athletes are doing very well, and then anyone below that is sort of breaking even. But obviously that's where, and there's all this competition between professional athletes because we're all competing for the same pot of money, not only in prize money, but also in sponsorship deals as well. So it can be quite challenging, but I think hopefully that is somewhere where the PTO will really generate a sort of, yeah, like I said, a new baseline for expectation.
Right. Well, listen, it's been great to catch up with you, Kat. I think you're going to be a big star, and you're a very articulate person as well. So I think you could be a good spokesperson for the sport as well. So I really appreciate you taking the time to chat. Any sponsors you want to give a shout out to while we're on? I mean, you might as well make the most of it. That's part of your job, isn't it? Looking after your sponsors.
I don't think they need shout outs. I think I'm definitely a believer of like honesty in my sort of media publicity. So I'm on Instagram and my website sort of lists as well all of the people who are supporting me as well. So
okay,
yeah.
Do you want to outline those social media things? We'll put them on the show notes so people can follow you.
Sure. My Instagram, I think if you just search for Kat Matthews, I'd come up. But it's KATR_Matthews is my sort of handle. I'm also on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, anything and everything probably to try and get some sort of attention, because unfortunately that's a big part of being a professional athlete.
Yeah. Yes. It's a big part of being a coach as well these days, and a podcast host.
Yeah.
If you're not doing it on social media, you're sort of irrelevant, aren't you, really?
I don't know. I still think my coach is probably one of the best, and he's the most down-to-earth coach I've met. So
yeah, well, he's clearly the best for you, having got you to this point. And that's, again, if that's working for you, that's great, isn't it? So
yeah, definitely.
Well, listen, just tell us before you go, then, what's the future hold? Immediately, you've got Daytona, then what? Assuming we get back to normality in 2021.
So 2 weeks Daytona, and then 2 weeks off, and then 2 weeks doing some sort of fun adventure with some cycling probably and some cocktails, and then 2021 I'm actually really sort of basking in the idea that I don't have to do another Ironman to try and look for qualification. Now I've got that slot at Kona in October, so I really TBC on races next year. I think I just try and maintain some flexibility because I can, and just really invest into some really low intensity training again, because it worked for me this year. So I feel like it's just another year that I can sort of ground myself and enjoy the easy miles.
You don't have any sort of contractual requirements from BMC to do a particular number of races or a certain races at home to improve your profile? Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping to be at the 70.3 World Champs as well. So that's 3 weeks before in St. George and Utah.
Okay. Oh, well, that'll be good. Get a bit of heat acclimatisation there. And it's altitude.
Yeah, exactly.
It's altitude as well, isn't it, St. George, I think?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't looked up yet. It's a bit far away from me to start race planning.
Maybe not. It'd be nice and hot, though, out there in Utah. Yeah, great. Well, be good to see you in Kona next year at the big dance, hopefully. Hopefully we all get back there.
Yeah, it's quite exciting. I never thought I had, I'm still a bit sort of speechless from the idea of being on that start line, but not just being on the start line, but also having the confidence now to sort of expect, you know, a really good performance from myself. I think that the course record in Florida really gave me that sort of boost to say, actually, like, start aiming a little bit higher again. So that's quite fun to think about.
Well, and now that WTC have gone back to the first past the post principle of races, makes it a lot easier, doesn't it, than having to scramble for points at the last minute, because you had a couple of good races, but somebody's been travelling the world and have racked up six races and got one step ahead of you in the rankings.
Yeah. Well, I've never experienced that old style. So for me, yeah, the idea of winning a race and ticking the box is pretty decent.
Perfect. Well, let's hope you have a great race in Daytona and it all pans out nicely and you can carry that Florida form through there. Will be interesting. We'll put a link to that so people can tune in and watch it. And also we'll get your number shared once the start list has been published. Definitely good luck with enjoying a couple of weeks off and some cocktails. That sounds like the better part of the deal. And then,
definitely. I can't wait.
Be interesting to see how you go next year. Maybe we'll catch up in Kona and do another podcast.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Simon.
All right, Kat. Well, everybody, that was Kat Matthews, fresh from her victory in Florida and getting ready to race in Daytona. Thank you so much, Kat. Enjoy the rest of your time out there in the sunshine and enjoy your end of season break.
Thanks very much.
Okay, take care now. And thanks again, listeners. We'll be here next week with another great guest. Bye for now. Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.